For the benefit of those who have just joined us today, I thought maybe we'll just go through a quick overview of where we've been, at least not all of it, but some of it, to at least bring you to some level of understanding about the six paramitas. So the six paramitas are generosity, morality, tolerance or patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. Perfections. That's the English translation for paramita. And it means, paramita means gone to the other side, to the other shore. It's a word we are probably most familiar with through the Heart Sutra, where we, say Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom. So the paramitas that we're studying in this Denkoi is really in relationship to the development of character. And so far we have looked at four different paramitas. The first one is generosity, and if we consider most importantly impartiality and non-discriminating as elements, foundational elements of generosity. We, as practitioners, are familiar with the phrase giver, receiver, and gift. And in that, each of the three are empty of inherent self-existence, and therefore the practice of generosity is designed or there for us to learn to loosen our attachment to not only possessions, things, and other people, but also to ourself. The teaching of no self begins with generosity. Secondly is morality. And that addresses restraint, the cultivation of virtue, and then altruistic cultivation. That has to do with the Bodhisattva vow, to help liberate all beings, to be there. Shantideva, who is one of the early teachers in Buddhism, says that the protection of all beings is accomplished through examination of one own mistakes. We should put that plural, right? Mistakes. Mm-hmm. Morality then also considers the precepts as something that you would refrain from, and the corresponding virtues. When we next convene in the dining room, you may want to check out the picture that's on the, I don't know what direction it's in, but anyway, it's on the wall with pictures of our ancestors, and it does cover not only virtues, but also the precepts. Then the third one is tolerance or patience, and the first thing to do in patience or tolerance is to adjust the mind to accept suffering. Suffering is the first noble truth, and no one escapes. So we all get sick, get injured, and we will die. So don't waste your energy on destructive habits. of dejection or despair. Milarepa has a very poignant claim. He says, beyond being without fear of what is ultimately true, there is no other tolerance. So what is it that is ultimately true? Everything changes. There's no fixed self. Everything is empty of inherent self-existence. And so we think, well, how can one begin this practice? And the first place is with our own conditioning. We can look at our own lives and see, you know, where we came from that resulted in today's maybe feelings and beliefs, projections, all good material for investigating tolerance or patience when it's absent. There's also the teaching of non-duality in a tolerance or patience, in that seeing self and other as not separate will help one be able to let go of the irritation or of anger or frustration, because no doubt the other may be having similar feelings, if not at that moment. They're just like you, so they no doubt will have had those feelings or will in the future. So it's really to see self and other with no separation. And then the fourth one is energy. And there's the energy, physical energy and mental energy, as well as emotional energy. And with applied effort, the bodhisattva can then work toward the goal of liberating all beings and face the suffering that he or she experiences, as well as other forms of distress, and still have the strength and courage to continue. So courage is an important element of energy, because we need courage in this practice when we may find ourselves going alone. In other words, maybe family and friends don't understand what you're up to, and so you end up practicing by yourself. Or, of course, you may join a sangha, but it's your circle, your immediate circle, may not understand what you do in this practice. So you also need energy to work with afflicted emotions, the hindrances, and so it's energy that affords one the strength to go on. And in this, there's a shift that occurs with the fourth paramita. And the first three paramitas, generosity, morality, and tolerance or patience, really can be practiced by everyone. But when you move into the last three of effort or energy, meditation and wisdom, now the practitioner has shifted focus towards the spiritual awakening. And so you can see how one needs effort to carry this work, to carry on with this work. And also, one of the benefits at this stage is that confidence, self-confidence is developed and arises. And what it offers one is really, because this kind of confidence is not, it's devoid of conceit. It doesn't have that element. And so it's really a confidence about your decision. It's about being grounded in the path and being grounded in oneness, in your true self. And that confidence really carries you forward in myriad ways. There's many associated benefits with it, what I can tell you. But it's a noticeable experience to have this self-confidence. It sets aside self-doubt about the path, and you know that it's right for you. So today, we're going to talk about meditation. And I have a list of what it's not. This was, or at least not only what it's not, but the misconceptions. And it's prepared by Venerable Gunaratana. And here goes the list. There's about 11 of them. So meditation is just a relaxation technique. Meditation means going into a trance. Meditation is a mysterious practice that cannot be understood. The purpose of meditation is to become a psychic super being. Meditation is dangerous, and a prudent person should avoid it. Meditation is for saints and holy men, not regular people. Meditation is running away from reality. Meditation is a great way to get high. Meditation is selfish. When you meditate, you sit around thinking lofty thoughts. I don't know, they haven't been in my mind. But a couple of weeks of meditation and all my problems will be gone. Sure. How many years now? Still waiting. Not really. So now we know what it's not. So what is it? Sorry, I have to use my glasses. I think I've been straining. They're watering too much. So meditation in Buddhism is used to develop and cultivate certain states of mind that are conducive to enlightenment. And, of course, because of this practice, it requires, strenuous exercise in doing the practice. So you have to have, some rigor about meditation in order for it to actually be effective in your life. It also requires a level of mindfulness. So there's a distinction, another distinction between the first three paramitas and then, the first four and then the last two of meditation and wisdom. And that distinction has to do with the matter of merit. There's associated merit with practicing patience and generosity. But in the practice of energy, you start seeing how you turn over the merit to others as, you know, energy becomes more developed in your own life as you turn your life towards the practice of a Buddhist way. And in meditation and wisdom, that carrot, so to speak, of merit isn't really needed. And at least because it's inherent both in meditation and in wisdom, so it's there of itself. So what are we doing in meditation? You know, what's the aim? And when we think about it, it's really about eliminating afflicted emotions or some type of hindrances that are really creating unhappiness in our life, that are causing suffering for ourselves and others. So meditation offers us the opportunity to actually see more about ourselves than otherwise we would be able to in just normal everyday living. So the actual process of sitting down opens us up to more of who we are and what is really the nature of reality. Early on, there were meditations designed just to counter the obstructions or hindrances. So maybe a person might meditate on take as an object. There are, you know, huge lists of objects for meditation. You might consider one of the four elements, or you might consider any kind of repulsion, you know, like there's a whole series of meditations around repulsion of a corpse in various stages of dissolution. Or you might, you know, consider recollections of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or virtues, or other topics like impermanence. And probably most familiar to all practitioners is the object of breathing as a place to start. So depending on the object, would be the focus of those meditation would be the object, and it would be investigated in different aspects. So the first way one looks at meditation or experiences meditation is with the mindfulness aspect of it. But there are other levels, and the next one might be reflective awareness. And this is really where you start questioning, you know, what is really going on, what maybe is causing some of the suffering, or how do things arise in your own life. And then another layer would be reflexive awareness, where you're actually looking at the object and the object has become one. In other words, the subject and object, there's no separation there. The two styles of meditative practice are calming meditation and then The second one is more of insight meditation. So we have samadhi and then vipassana as the words that are used. Calming is the stabilization of focusing the mind. So it's associated with concentration. And especially if you would take breathing as the object, you would be tuning into the inflow and outflow of the breath, and that would result in a calming of the mind. Now, as you continue that focus, then you'd start experiencing more of what's called the deeper composure of the mind, or a concentrated state. Let's see if we want to... So, our ancestor Dogen, let's see if we can find it. By the way, whoever found my chant book, thank you very much. I don't know how it came to me today or yesterday, but I appreciate it. So Dogen also has language that addresses samadhi and vipassana, but it's in very different kind of expression. So he goes like this in the self-fulfillment samadhi. When one displays the Buddha mudra with one's whole body and mind, excuse me, sitting upright in this samadhi, even for a short time, everything in the entire Dharma world becomes Buddha mudra, and all space in the universe completely becomes enlightenment. So you can clearly see he is describing a state of calmness and concentration. An interesting fact that I really hadn't encountered before was, and never really thought about it, but Wright in his book on the six perfections is that in this state that we're talking about in samadhi, the three poisons, greed, hate, and delusion, as well as the hindrances, aversion, attraction, or desire, restlessness, worry, sloth, torpor, doubt, cannot gain ground in this state. So, these states, this particular state is often referred to as dhyana, or sometimes jhana, and there are different levels of within this state of samadhi. Early on, dhyana was the word chosen to describe meditation. That was, how it was translated. Somehow it got associated only with calming meditation, and then it shifted again a little later with Shantideva, and when he incorporated both samadhi as well as vipassana under the name of dhyana, paramita. So, vipassana entails thoughts that are actually capable of giving rise to wisdom. So, what is this wisdom? It's really to experience the way things are, truly are. There's no greed, no hate, no delusion, no fear. Nothing to obstruct it. It is a very unique experience to realize the truth about the nature of reality. So the early Buddhist teachers structured meditation around characteristics of existence. So when we talk about the three modes of existence, we talk about things of being impermanent, that there's suffering and no self. And it's with these three aspects that one can sit down and begin to practice. So for example, you could take something from everyday experience, something from one's conditioning, something like maybe the idea of somebody that you have of somebody being either snobbish or arrogant, and work with that in your meditation. You could first look at the suffering that it's caused yourself and maybe the other person. They may not feel it directly, but maybe in your projections and your interactions may have resulted in some suffering that you don't really know about. There might be you might express some negative thoughts about that through speech, and in effect create some negative karma as a result of your belief or your attitude about this person. And then the next thing you might want to consider is impermanence, and really think about how long have you had this view, and really does it hold true right now, and when did it initially arise? And, you know, like that happened in the past, but now is the present. Is that belief still true? So we tend to operate a lot on what's called a referent. When we encounter somebody or a situation, we have the image gets created in our mind. And then when we meet that person again or encounter that situation, we automatically go back to that referent. It's very interesting. You can test this out for yourself, but it happens all the time. So we are walking along the street, sidewalk, and we see somebody we know, and if you think about it, you go back into your mind of who you think this person is. You're not seeing them as they really are as they come towards you. You're actually looking back in your mind at the experience that you had of that at an earlier encounter. And generally, that one will stick with you. Doesn't matter how they change. You know, years can go by, but you're always going back to that reference. Test that out for yourself. See if that actually happens in your life. It's uncanny. That's how we bring the past into the present, and how we actually limit the present. So one can say, well, how does one kill the moment? How do you kill the moment? You kill the moment by going back to your referent and not really being present to what's happening right here when you're interacting with a person. So consider that. So what's in the past somehow stays with us. And then the other way we could look at the situation with our belief about somebody being either snobbish or arrogant is consider no self. Like there's really no separation between self and other, and you know, we can look at that and say, well, what is arrogance? You know, who's arrogant, me or the other person? am I projecting that onto somebody? Or, you know, so it gets a little bit tricky there. And but it's still all really good information when you really want to be serious about investigating your hindrances and your own obstructions. Another theme in this particular perfection, the perfection of meditation, is one of compassion. And in Shantideva's The Bodhisattva Way of Life, there's a whole practice around exchanging self for other. It's Lojong. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with Norman Fisher, who is the former abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, but he recently released a book that is called Training in Compassion. And what he's done is he's taken this practice of Lojong, of exchanging self and other for other, and put it in Zen terms. So it should be kind of an interesting book if you've ever studied this Lojong practice. It's quite it's an excellent way to really systematically develop compassion. And it sounds pretty weird, but because it helps us break down those barriers, because we're always thinking about ourselves first before we think of other people. And then when we, even if we consider our circle, we have a very small circle. We first consider our family and then our friends, people we like, and then we get a little bigger. But, you know, we actually, as practitioners, you know, we're here for the benefit of all beings. And so this practice is one that can help you expand your circle to incorporate all beings. Some would say that because of, or as a result of practice, especially meditative practice, one develops some powers. I'm just sharing them with you. I can't say, you know, we'll leave these up to you, but I'll give you the list. The first is divine eye. This is the ability to see suffering beings near and far and in other worlds. Then there's the divine ear to hear calls for assistance. It sounds like Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, regarder of the cries of the world, who listens for the cries of the world. Then the third one is the power of knowledge of other minds. The fourth is remembrance of previous births. And then the fifth is magical powers. So I just, you know, put them out there, but, you know, it's classic study of meditation. Now, this author that I've been working with for the Six Perfections is Dale Wright. And he has his own system of levels of consciousness that he has proposed, and I mentioned them very briefly at the beginning. And he says that these levels of consciousness are layers of awareness. So the first one would be the immediate experience that we're having, direct awareness. We would hear sounds, we would taste the chocolates, we would see smiles, sadness. So whatever is directly in front of you and in your milieu, you would be able to pick up on that. Sometimes it would even extend into interactions with other people. You can read the situation. You can also read the other people to see what's going on with them, basically by their demeanor or some other gestures or signs. So training here is, in this level of consciousness or layer of consciousness, is really to let go. To let go of those experiences, because that can just fill up your mind. And this is where training in mindfulness is invaluable, because mindfulness can actually bring you back to the present, which is what you want to do. So whether if it starts out that, you know, you're in some mind stream, you can direct your mind to hearing sounds. I personally find the jays here at Jokoji always a wake-up call. Oh. Hearing sounds, yes. So that's one layer of awareness in our consciousness. The second one is reflective thinking. And this is the awareness where one actually does do some analysis. You might question, how did that happen? Where's that going? You have a number of questions about your experience. You're just trying to sort it out. You might, consider the full range of questions at this stage, because really, in order for one to wake up, one has to do the work. And that's why reflective thinking is an important aspect. Mindfulness alone will not help you become awake. Mindfulness is an invaluable practice, but it needs to be coupled with additional layers of awareness. So reflective thinking is one of those. And then the third layer is called reflexive. This may sound very familiar to you. And in reflexive awareness or consciousness, the mind bends back in awareness on itself. As I mentioned, in this meditation, the subject and the object are identical. So here, one gains more self-knowledge about who you really are, about your true self. And you would also come to realize how you're not separate from anybody else. How interdependent is the nature of reality. So our ancestor Dogen, in the fascicle Fukanza Zengi, has some instructions for us. So see if what he's saying is exactly like right. But he uses different terms. This is like an excerpt from it, I think. So this is universally recommended instructions for Zazen. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a breath and exhale. Rock your body right and left and settle into steady, immobile sitting. Think of not thinking. Not thinking? What kind of thinking is that? beyond thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. The Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. It is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the koan realized. Traps and snares can never reach it. If you grasp the point, you are like a dragon gaining water, like a tiger taking to the mountains. For you must know that the true Dharma appears of itself, so that from the start, dullness and distraction are struck aside. Sounds like the same, right? Thinking could be our reflective thinking, and not thinking is the reflexive, or non-thinking would be in those levels of awareness. It's just Dogen's way is so beautiful. Let's see. So when we're in this meditative state, one could consider material from the Heart Sutra, and that would be the five skandhas, or the five aggregates. That's always a good place to start. So what you may have questions about form, about the body and the five senses, or maybe with regard to feelings, you know, maybe expressions of that you found disturbing, either approvals or disapprovals. And then there's perceptions, how we view the world, how people view us. And then this morning's Heart Sutra, there was the word impulses. I've also heard it mental formations. So volitional forces that guide us in our environment in terms of desires or wishes. And then, of course, self-consciousness that holds everything together. At least it appears so. Of course, no, it doesn't. There is, in Western culture, we have that Christian Judeo tradition, and there is this teaching of soul and a body, and but actually, from a Buddhist perspective, you know, that's considered dualistic, and so the teaching of emptiness is one that is foundational in Buddhism, and one must continue to investigate what does that really mean and realize it for yourself. And an excellent way to do that is in your Zazen practice. So you have to test out your thinking and to see if what you're thinking and believing and feeling is really true, and whether or not things are as concrete as we believe them to be. Are they that fixed? Or does, in fact, everything change and therefore have the characteristic of everything is impermanent. And that means there's no self. So it's a difficult teaching, but you have the equipment to investigate this. You have your Zazen practice, which is a boundless source of self-discovery, if you just open yourself up to it. Because every level of consciousness that you enter into actually brings you greater freedom. So it starts with mindfulness, and when you move into reflective or concentration, you will test out and no longer be fooled by what is appearing in your mind. And then in non-thinking, you will actually experience things as they are, and you'll learn who you are in relationship to that experience of oneness, and that you're not really separate, and that this is all very normal. We're all doing this. So I have some questions now for you. Because I'm always curious too about people's own experience about meditation, and whether or not one is able to experience, as even Dogen says, about thinking, not thinking, and beyond thinking or non-thinking. Are you able to actually see the states change? Anybody care to share? Yes.
I'm an employer, and I have employees, so I'm always suffering. But Zazen helps me be a better person. There was this incident where one of my employees broke a pitchfork. And the old me would have been really angry, but the new me was like concerned, you know, were they hurt? And I looked at myself and was surprised of my reaction, because I would have never done that before, you know, or maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit, but I stopped, you know, and went, oh, you know, are you okay? So it was okay, you know, to... break the tool and not your body.
Ah, the transformative power of Zazen. It's amazing. Yes. Thank you, Green. Yes, John.
So there's this natural state that people can go into, whether they've been doing Zazen or not, whether they've never even heard of meditation before, where your mind stops thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And also, after a lot of meditation, generally you gain the ability to have that quiet mind. It's just stops thinking. Mm-hmm. If you're in a very holy place or high vibration, that often happens. No thought, no need to think. And then you're a little more in reality, because the thoughts are just the disruption, really, not the reality.
Thanks for bringing that up about it is a natural state. And it, so we're working on.
We're cooperating with our evolution. That's what my first meditation teacher, who was a woman, said to me was, "Well, I look at it, because everyone had views like I'm sort of the not atheist, but it's the views, anyway, sort of
agnostic. No,
okay. And the philosophers have been, so, but she would say, "Well." You see, I believe we're cooperating with our evolution. That's what you're really doing. It's going to happen anyway, but whether you cooperate with it or not, if you sit and do Zazen, you're cooperating with your evolution.
Well, excellent. That works for us. How about insight meditation? Do many people find that that's useful? Do you find yourself moving from samadhi to insight, or vipassana. Do you have that experience? So sometimes when you're really settled, very settled, very calm, and concentrated, you might have a question about something that's come up in your in a teaching or a chant, or even in your own experience, and you can ask the question. You can actually ask a number of questions depending on how many come up for you. Sometimes I find you only have one, or maybe you have two or three, but then you know it's like there aren't any more, and then you go back into samadhi. So it's a very natural process to shift from insight. Yes, Jonathan.
Yeah, sometimes the insight is like more psychological.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's more philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
But they can refer to either one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sometimes there's just like some concept, like say non-self or something, comes up and you just have this clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of turn it around and see it in all these different angles, and it's almost exciting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even at times it can be distracting, because maybe it's just so cool. It's like I want to keep phrasing this in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
To myself, but actually there's a point where you kind of put it down again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you kind of run out of, or, yeah, you just know it's time to let go.
But that was also my question, I guess. So insight could refer to also kind of psychological,
mm-hmm.
Cause and effect type things, or...
Yes, absolutely. You know, how, yes, definitely. You know, something that, you know, is... I personally found like a repetitive pattern in my life that I couldn't quite figure out. I mean, I looked at that for years, couldn't quite figure it out. And then, you know, one day it just showed up. I finally got the answer. But it does require you have to keep asking the question. Sometimes you don't get an answer, you know. Just like, okay, next time. But you just keep asking. The other is that you can kind of test out that experience, and one of them is you know, test to see if there's any fear there. It's when you're in those states. You know, earlier it was said that you don't experience greed, hate, and delusion, or the afflicted emotions. And one of the things that I would always see is, okay, is there anything in here to be afraid of? Anything going to come out and bite me? But still here to tell you no.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Would you clarify, you used the word samadhi, and I'm not sure I know exactly. Was that the state you're talking about where you're not thinking about anything at all?
Samadhi is a concentration. Yes, it's a, well, it's, there are, you know, levels of it, but it starts with, you know, you enter it in through mindfulness or awareness, and then you drop into a more focused and concentrated state. You can start with some reflective kinds of thinking in samadhi, where you're, you know, kind of sorting out maybe something in your life or some other... issue, maybe in a teaching or whatever. But then when that stops and becomes very concentrated, there isn't thinking going on in non-thinking.
So they're both samadhis, or just different?
They're just layers of, we would call it samadhi.
So what exactly does samadhi mean? I don't know. I've never heard it used this in this way.
Mm. Do you know the actual translation, samadhi?
Mm-hmm. The root of sama means unity or connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard it translated as meditative absorption. So you place, rather than concentration or apply a certain focus, you just place your attention on the object of your attention, and everything else falls away. So it's kind of like the sama means, the sama, samatha means like no separation. So there's no, in a certain sense, like in samadhi, there's no object of meditation because there's no separation.
Separation between myself, between what?
Yourself and God and the universe.
Between yourself and any kind of application toward a focus or a topic. Like traditionally we might be aware of our breath or our posture or something like that. That's how we receive instruction.
But
a state of samadhi is like there's no breather per se. There's just breathing.
Mm-hmm. Oneness, that's a translation. But I think that thing that's confusing is Val is using it in a Buddhist context, and the original Vedic and Hindu context, the stages, the Patanjali outline, you know, the first one was yama-niyama, morality, things that you should do, things you should not do, and the next comes posture, asana, so how to sit correctly. Mm-hmm. And then concentration, where everything else falls away, you're looking at that. And then next step is absorption.
Yeah.
And then after that is samadhi. Samadhi is oneness. Anything anything you would think about separate, it's not separate. You are it.
Right.
So you know anything about it. Now that might be different than how I think that's different than how the Buddhist context is.
Not much, I don't think. It's called formless. Formless. In fact, our practice of just sitting is considered formless meditation because we don't take an object.
We don't meditate on a form like a Shiva or Manjushri or deity.
Or even an object. We don't take an object. It may initially take the breath as an object, but beyond that, once that's let go, then there is no object. You just really are looking at what is arising and letting it go.
Thank you. Oh, I think I
put
together
some of this picture.
Yes, Chris.
I find the talk really interesting because although I've only been practicing pretty arduously for a short time, I have read Zen for many years and actually sat many, many years ago. And it seems like everything that I've read over the years has been about just sitting. Mm-hmm. I mean, the focus on not focusing, shikantaza, or however you label it. And so I've had a lot of the experiences that you've described as deliberate techniques, like reflexive meditation. Mm-hmm. I've had those things come up in Zazen and thought, well, that's not right. That's not it. And, the insight I mentioned the other day about the river and everything is the river. That came up because I was thinking about the duality of self and in Zazen.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, here I am just, wasting my time.
No.
So it's pretty interesting to hear that, and it would have been pretty cool to hear it a long time ago.
Sorry, I wasn't there. But it's here now, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think I have another question along the same line. You kind of ran over some things at the beginning of this talk about how did you describe it? It was like five or six abilities, was it?
Aversions.
What?
Aversion?
No, it wasn't aversions. It was five or six abilities that kind of come naturally that you grow into, you develop.
Perfections.
Abilities, what she was talking about. What you were talking about earlier was
powers. Powers. They were powers.
The cities.
And it's like I've also never heard that. I always hear that it's all you're supposed to do is be mindful. So it was really eye-opening when you said, oh, no, you can't get to enlightenment through just being mindful. I was like, I always was wonder suspicious about that. So it's interesting that people don't talk about it.
Well, today, in modern society, we have mindfulness practices, right? I mean, mindfulness, there's secular mindfulness, Have you not heard about it?
Yeah.
Secular, you know, mindfulness. And generally, you know, maybe their objective is different. Might be to find some form of relaxation. They might want to eliminate, you know, headaches or migraine headaches, or reduce the blood pressure, or number of any number of medical reasons, or, you know, addiction. You know, any, you know, there are so people suggest mindfulness practices. So that's a secular approach to mindfulness. And if you think about that, that's not necessarily enough to move you into toward awakening.
So that's what you're talking about when you said mindfulness alone won't get you to awakening. You're talking about the secular.
Well, it isn't only secular, but I mean, you know, if you're chopping wood and cutting carrots, you know, without the supporting of teaching of this practice, maybe you wouldn't even consider in this going in this direction. So actually, that's why the paramitas are really considered more of a hierarchy, you know, starting with generosity. So you're going up the ladder, in a sense, to help you support, you know, you as you develop and your practice develops. So, I don't know. I haven't sat through any mindfulness, secular mindfulness classes, but you know, it's on HuffPost Live. You know, you can get 5 things to be mindful about that day or whatever. So, you know, it's very prevalent.
Okay, good.
It's in our society now. That's good. That's good. It's a start. Any other comment?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Could you elaborate more on the
reference? Okay. So, this is a teaching that comes out of Yogacara, which is early Mahayana Buddhism. And it has to do with aspects of mind, thought, and consciousness. And one of the teachings is that the way our mind works is that we will, encounter a situation, and what we do is create an image. And then we store that image in our mind. And that becomes the referent. So, sometimes, no matter how much you interact with a person, the person or yourself may always go back to the referent. Have you had the experience of your parent always seeing you as a 12-year-old? I mean, that's a classic example. The mother believes you're 12, even though you're now 45, 50, 60. Mother thinks you're 12, and you can tell because she's knitting you something of a, you know, for a 12-year-old, and it's like, oh, mom, you know. So we do this. The issue is, can you see it in yourself? How, when you meet people, what is the first thing that happens? We associated with the idea of referent is the notion of appropriating mind. So what the mind will do, it will, as soon as you have something in your vision, it will, vision is really pretty impactful. So it will look at what is presented, and it will immediately appropriate and go back to their referent. And it appropriates certain traits that are familiar. The mind is lazy, basically lazy. There, in fact, there's some studies out recently. I don't know, where's Tim when you need him? I mean, my husband's telling me about some new studies where they actually can identify that this is happens in your mind, that you actually go immediately to the referent. Your mind appropriates some traits that are familiar, and rather than think about it, and raise some consciousness and ask some questions about how real is it, or is it new or old or whatever, it immediately goes back to where you are.
So my other question is, like, that's how language works, and that's how we relate to people, is through language. Mm-hmm. That's our tool. And language is just a sign, it's just mm-hmm. pointing to reference. And how can we, you know, get past our how can I forgive if I have this preconceived notion of a person as the referent when I'm using, like, another sign system of reference to try to get past it?
So that's, well, your practice of Zazen is the starting point, because that is what helps you to bring you to the present moment. So through your process of when you're doing just sitting, shikantaza, you let go, as because you're in formless meditation, you're not taking on an object, you're basically, as something arises, you see it and let it go. That practice is transformative. So next time when you see somebody, instead of, like, as soon as you see them, you might, you know, have that experience, but you might pause again, take a breath, and then be able to be present and actually see the person. So habits are very hard to break. So you have to work at it and be conscious of it. And the way through that is through your practice of Zazen. It starts the process. Mm-hmm. Yes, Jonathan?
So can you... Sometimes I have this experience of steering or directing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like, maybe what you would call just mindfulness, where you're just kind of watching whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And exercising some, maybe, I don't want to say indifference, but objectivity toward the different phenomena that are
mm-hmm.
happening. And then there's another experience that I have sometimes where I'm really, really directing the action. Like, okay, now it's, like, really time to count the breaths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or now it's like, now I really drifted off there. Come on, get with it.
Mm-hmm.
Get with the program.
Mm-hmm.
So what I find is, though, is that kind of steering kind of makes
mm-hmm.
waves
mm-hmm.
because there's these value judgments going
mm-hmm.
on about how well I'm doing or...
Mm-hmm.
So kind of the question is, like, how much to direct and when not to, when to let it go, and that's it.
Well, when it consumes your whole... you know, 40 minutes, and you know it's time to let go of it. Do you ever have the experience where I get, oh my God, 20 minutes must have passed, and it's like 30, and I only got 10 minutes or 2 minutes left, and you've spent that whole time just like, yeah. All you can do is, next time you sit down, just, you know, keep practicing, knowing that if you have a tendency to do that, you know, you can vow or intend before you start not to engage in that. So use intention as a mechanism to direct it in less conscious ways.